Most South Africans only encounter the law at the end of the process, when it's already passed, already signed, already affecting their lives. But between an idea and a signature is a long, political and often invisible journey through parliament, committees, amendments, negotiations and compromise. Today's show is about that journey. And I have two guests on opposite ends of it. First, Ivo Chipkin, director at New South Institute, whose bill on professionalizing the public service and protecting it from political interference has now reached the president's desk and awaits his signature. He can tell us what it takes for a bill to survive politics and reach the finish line. And Makoshule Gana, chief organizer of Rise Mzansi, whose bill on reforming gambling, particularly online gambling, is just starting its journey through parliament. He will show us what it's like to navigate the process from the very beginning. By placing these two moments side by side, we're going to unpack how laws in South Africa are actually made, who holds power at each stage, and where reform gets stuck, and why good ideas don't always survive politics. This is Level Up. So we'll start at the point where most people actually never get to hear about how an idea becomes a bill. And Ivo, you're at the end of your life stage, so let's start with you. Why was it so important for you putting this bill into the system and how it has wound its way through?
So this is a bill, actually, to say that it's I'm still amazed that it is a bill and we've got this far at all, because this is an idea that has been gestating now for a very, very long time. I know that I've been working on these issues for, actually, that'll age me so dramatically, at least 15, 20 years.
So you started when you were 5.
Exactly. From when I was 3 years old, I've been focusing on this issue. No, so quite early on in the transition from apartheid, there started to be concern around performance of government, coming from the presidency in particular. So in 1998, there's a Presidential Review Commission. It's primarily concerned, driven by Mandela, Mbeki's very involved though, around that government departments are not working. They're not working as they're supposed to be doing, and there's a growing concern within the African National Congress that the ability of the public service to implement ANC policies is not there yet. So there's a discussion around what those issues are. I'd come into these issues through the UDF and working with civic organizations in the 1980s. I had become very enthusiastic about the prospects of a radical democratic government was, and I became interested in these questions of public service and administration and bureaucracy as a sense of, as the transmission belt between new policies, post-apartheid policies, and actually making an impact on the ground. But there was a sense that something was going wrong around in that transmission belt. So I've been interested in that for a very long time. About 10 years ago, that understanding started to develop in a much more concrete understanding that one of the key challenges was the fact that in South Africa, we had muddled deliberately the difference between political office, politicians, the role of politicians, and professional public servants. That we hadn't adequately distinguished between those roles, that effectively we had politicians who were also acting as administrators, and we had administrators who also functioned as politicians, that we hadn't clearly discriminated between those two roles. Internationally, more and more, it's the norm to distinguish between those roles. So I was as an academic, interested in understanding why we muddle those roles, and we can talk about that. That's a long way. But so what started to emerge is that concretely this was something really important. It became an issue which was crystallized in the National Development Plan in 2014, around that period. And I've been working on it for the longest of time with not much success. Then incredibly, there was this moment of reform-mindedness within government, and especially driven by senior public servants. I'd been involved, but it was really senior officials in the DPSA, Department of Public Service Administration, that started to take up this issue. And working with them, Yolisa Makasi was very important, who was the Director General of the DPSA, who then later came to work at NSI, developed a bill. Incredibly, that bill got through into the National Assembly. And then we started working on getting it through. And then in November, unbelievably, it passed in the National Council of Provinces. So it's now the idea of the bill being drafted, I think, was a historical breakthrough. It landed in Parliament is just astonishing. Getting passed in the National Assembly is a remarkable event. And then the fact that it's now complete the process in the National Council of Provinces in November, for me, is one of these great, remarkable life achievements.
We're going to talk a little bit more about all of those processes. But I want to know from you, Makashule, why your bill, you feel now is the time to act, because you're talking about gambling reform and in particular online gambling, and you're at the very beginning of the stage.
Yeah, thanks. Just to say the why you need bills or why laws change or why new laws are enacted, it's the kind of society that you want to live in. Sometimes it's what you assume to be true, say 10, 15 years ago, has not turned out to be true. Mm. So what that needs is that you need a change in laws. So laws, by their nature, are not permanent. You know, they are all subject to change, including the Constitution, by the way.
Mm.
I know we reference the Constitution a lot in this country. So the Constitution itself is also subject to change, because the environment or some of the things that we thought were desirable 29 years ago, or the world that we existed in 29 years ago, it no longer exists. Mm-hmm. So you need to update the laws. And in some instances, you need to create new laws from scratch, you know, like, because there are developments in society globally that necessitate for you to do new laws. And in this particular instance, especially in the gambling landscape, and it's something that I have been campaigning for a while now, for the reforms. What happened there is that, so just to give a bit of a background, so after the transition to democracy, there was a gambling act, because, you know, back in the days when you had
You had to go to Botswana.
You had to go to Botswana. You had to go to Transkei. You had to go to Venda to gamble, because, quote unquote, gambling was not allowed in South Africa.
Yeah.
So you had to go to the independent states that had the gambling site. So the idea was then to have some kind of a National Gambling Act, which was passed in 1996. But it was so inadequate because, you know, like, you are trying to amalgamate different regulations that existed, and it was done in a hush-hush way, that you then had in 2004 the National Gambling Act. Now, it's a bit, by then, it made sense because of the, let's call it, the gambling environment landscape that existed then in 2004.
Sure.
But even then, there was starting to be, you know, concerns around online gambling.
And betting.
And betting. So what that law said is that there needs to be another regulation around online gambling, which the 2008 amendment, sorry about that, was supposed to deal with it. The bill was passed but never signed into law. So it was passed by the National Assembly, the National Council of Provinces, but never got signed into law.
Mm. I'm getting nervous.
In 2008, there have been attempts since 2018 to push some amendments to the Gambling Act, which at the moment, just got stuck at the National Council of Provinces. And the reason, and in 30 seconds, so you have laws that impacts provinces. We call them Section 76 bills. So that law needs to pass the National Assembly. It needs to pass the National Council of Provinces. So with this particular 2018 gambling amendment, it passed the National Assembly. But when it got to the National Council of Provinces, it got stuck. And the reason it got stuck is because it was the law wanted to take some powers from the provincial licensing authorities, the provincial gambling boards. So provinces kind of said, no, we are not going to allow this to happen. So they blocked the law. Since 2018, it's been blocked. There were attempts last year to revive. We tried to mediate. A mediation happens where the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces are not agreeing on a piece of legislation. That mediation did not succeed. So we now have a situation where we have a gambling landscape that has sharply evolved in a big way. I mean, most countries, whether it's Australia, the UK, the US.
Well, even the US,
yeah.
Even though they're federated, they have similar issues all over. And when we look at the numbers, last year's report from our gambling numbers in South Africa are astounding, and how much that has started to seep through society.
So you have this crisis that's happening, but then there's the legislation and the regulation, especially the regulation, has not kept up. And I've said this, maybe I should repeat it for the second last time, is that we had a minister who was employed for 60 months, Minister Patel. Not once did he look at gambling. Not once did he convene the National Gambling Policy Council.
Former Trade and Industry. Ghana, what is it called now?
It's Trade, Industry, and Competition. Not once. So for 5 years, actually the industry was on autopilot. So now we are trying to get a lot of the structures as the Gambling Act to do what they are supposed to do. But we are also encouraged because there are various ways to tackle this.
So before you talk about the various ways, what I'm hearing very clearly from what you're saying is that once a bill has entered Parliament, it no longer belongs to the author. It's got a life of its own over there. And I'm interested to know what compromises have to happen, if any, where you talk about being stuck at provincial level because they're fighting to keep some of that power, these power plays. What are some of the biggest challenges that, and where were you stuck the most, and what compromises did you have to make?
Well, in our case, we needed to anticipate where the resistance would come from. So we spent a lot of time thinking about that because this is a very controversial bill, and I think it couldn't have happened at an earlier period of time, because essentially what the bill does is it takes the powers away from politicians in such fundamental areas of government that it's almost incredible. Essentially, it takes the powers of politicians, of ministers, the president, MECs, to appoint staff in departments and to make day-to-day operational decisions inside departments, which is currently what they do. So it's a very fundamental piece of legislation. It's an amendment to the Public Service Act, which deprives politicians of key sources of their authority inside the state.
How did you respond to those pressures?
So since the election in 2024, since May, there's been a huge political shift in the country. The ANC lost its overall majority. It's the largest party in Parliament, but it's not the dominant party anymore. I think there's a growing awareness that more and more other parties are growing and coming to the fore, and that the ANC is in decline. And I think within the ANC and more generally, there's a sense that they do not want other parties or coalitions or other parties to inherit the powers of the public administrations, which they've exercised over the last 28 years or so, 29 years or so. So I think within the ANC, for the first time in our history, there was an appetite for these changes.
How does that respond to your coming from a much smaller party and you're sponsoring this bill in this way? How does this dynamic that I was talking about change some of the compromises that you may have to make within the process?
So when I started, I said the environment changes. The appetite of how we need to govern ourselves changes. Because if you look at democracy, it's a self-government. We set up rules to say this is how we would like to govern ourselves. This is how we would like to live. Mm. So when there's a pushback around, let's say, the bill that is referring to, which now becomes an act, it's for a long time, there was this appetite to say there needs to be a separation between the let's call it the administration or the operation and the political side. And that you need to professionalize the public service. What you want, you want the teacher to wake up in the morning and worry about teaching. A nurse must attend to the sick. They must not worry about who's in government or not. Because that's the kind of society that now we are getting into. That's what we want to say. If you are employed in the state, you are there to work for the people, not for the political party. So that came, the reason there was, let's call it, less resistance is because there's that appetite to say fundamentally how we have governed ourselves needs to change, for the better of society. I mean, to give an example, you can take Japan. I use Japan as an example because they change their governments a lot. If we think what sometimes happen in Johannesburg, it's a lot of changes. In Japan, they change their government a lot. I mean, there was a time where the longest, I think for a period of 14, 15 years, the longest serving government was like 2 years.
The administration.
The political leadership.
But the dominant party remains.
There were changes in who leads government.
Mm.
But the administration, so that is the bureaucracy and so forth, continue to do what it needs to do. The public servants continue to do what they need to do. So what you have in South Africa now is that you can accept that there's not going to be, at least for the next 10, 20 years, there's not going to be an outright winner of an election. So what you then need to do is to then strengthen the administrative side of government so that the changes in the political side of things on who becomes the premier, who becomes the mayor, who becomes the president does not affect whether the traffic lights
works
or not. That's where now I'm saying the change in taste and appetite on how we like to govern ourselves. And the same goes to, for instance, and this is how you need to look at the at laws that we make in parliament and the amendments that we make. Even in the gambling landscape, is to say what we assume to be true is no longer true. What is true, we need to then amend the legislation to respond to the crisis that we face at the moment. And that's what the laws are there for.
So, look, you're also talking in the gambling landscape. We're talking about politics and politicians and the work that people do, but there is also a very big stakeholder in terms of money. So the people with money, and when you're talking gambling, you're also talking about touching a stakeholder. And much talk has been had about who is funding whom,
yeah,
and where the money lies.
So let me say this. In every system has got its beneficiaries.
Who are resistant to change.
So there are those that benefit from the current situation. And for them, they will fight back. There will always be, and we must not be discouraged that people are fighting back or they are resisting the change. And no one, I reference this to say, you know what, whether it's in the legislation or any space, power is not given. The industry itself will not come out and say, no, actually you are undertaxing us. Tax us a little more. Regulate us a little more in advertising, regulate us a little more in sponsorship and so forth. They will not come up. They will pocket the profits now and then hoping that the changes will take for a long time. Because what they are used to, and this is something that we are grappling with in Parliament, is the time that it takes to enact legislation. From the bill, the processing, Parliament has to go through the call for comments to be submitted in writing. Then after that, it needs to go for... So we ask for written comments on a bill. So you give like 30 to 60 days for that. And then after that, you still need to go for public hearings.
Yes.
Then after the public hearings, there will always be someone. You know, like in this country, there's this... I guess it's the democracy we have chosen. Someone can wait until the last minute.
Then go to
court. So someone can wait until... So Parliament signs the legislation, agrees, so we vote, we all agree, this legislation is good. then someone does nothing about it. It's at the desk of the president. Immediately the president signs, people go to court. But there have been public hearings. There have been all these steps. Someone decides, no, I'm not going to get involved in that. I'll wait for the president to sign, and then I'll go to court. And by going to court, I'll delay the implementation of that legislation. Because these are some of the tactics, delaying tactics that sometimes happen. And I'm very much aware that, especially in the gambling, the changes that we are proposing, and that, for instance, Treasury has...
So how do you prepare for that kind of pressure?
You ensure that, because this fight takes place, let me give an instance. There will be fights that happens at the floor of parliament. So those ones, you make sure you win. But then there's the public, because these people have got money, lots of money. And they are going to hire the best lawyers. And they are going to muddy the waters in the public. So you need to ensure that whenever you get an opportunity, you highlight the importance of these changes and the benefits that need to go to society. You know, I'm the David here in this fight. I represent a two member party in parliament. Mm. I'm the David. But you know what? We are getting the changes. Treasury now has got a proposal on the gambling. So this does not require legislation. We can get the text whilst we work on the legislation. Because the other thing is, we need to say, what are the things that we can do with the current legislation? We do them whilst we amend the legislation and not wait to amend the legislation, then do the things that should have been done before.
So what, do you still have any worries? It's sitting now, at the end of the process. There are two things left. There is a political thing. There's a president that needs to sign the bill off and into an act. And from what you're telling us, there is still a potential of some kind of constitutionality being... have you got a...
So I'll tell you, what is interesting. So our focus was really on sort of building the case for the bill, which we did really well in the public domain and within political parties. The opponents, the people that were really opposed to us, were minority parties, were smaller parties. So ironically enough, it was the GNU that became an issue for us, because there were parties that were now in the GNU, opposition parties to the ANC that were now in the GNU, that now were sitting in very powerful positions. So for example, the key position in our case, the Minister of Public Service and Administration, came from an opposition party, came from the IFP. And the new minister was opposed to the bill. So he tried revealing stuff, which he tried quite hard to prevent the bill from he tried to get it removed from parliament on two occasions. And they were therefore need to keep the bill in the parliamentary process. So also within the DA supported the bill, but the Western Cape didn't. The Western Cape, I don't know what to get involved in internal DA politics, but it looks like the Western Cape went rogue relative to the DA position, because in the final voting of the provincial governments, the provincial government of the Western Cape was one of the legislators that didn't support the bill.
Sure.
So, and I think it's again because the opposition parties, many of the opposition parties who are now seeing themselves potentially as new governments or part of governing coalitions, they wanted those powers to be able to appoint public servants directly.
Their own people.
So they were, so they saw, some of them saw this bill as a threat. Jeez. So this is why I think I'm hopeful that Ramaphosa will sign this bill quite urgently. But I do think that there's a risk of the kind of advocacy or the kind of lawfare which we've seen in other situations arising.
So most people don't read bills.
Oh, then let me tell you the other thing, which was one of the big things which is in our advantage, is that South Africans, they go to sleep when you hear public administration. When you hear bureaucracy, when you hear exactly. public administration, they go to sleep. It's not like Brazil where these sorts of questions are sort of, you know, frontline stories in their daily newspapers. In South Africa, we go to sleep. No one's interested. It's most boring. If you're a public administration academic, you know, kind of there's a kind of a look of slight amusement, if not horror. How could you possibly be interested in this stuff? We go to sleep when it comes to public administration. So fortunately, it's not a topic which is – journalists have to be encouraged to write stories on this sort of stuff. So it's not a topic which is so urgently in the public domain. Ironically enough, that also helped us.
Speaking of topics in the public domain, how is it that some bills get so much attention? We've had multiple times had people on this show, and often the tobacco bill gets talked about. It's on everybody's lips. Everybody's talking about it. Why do some bills get so much attention and others not? Because with all of this, sounds like public harm that's being mitigated against, but people are interested in some things and some things not.
So I have said that every system has got its beneficiaries. When you attempt to change the system, those that benefited from the old order, who stand to lose with the new order, will stand up. So when you look at all these, let's call them, you say the bills that gets highlighted or they get front page news, it's who stands to lose when the law is enacted. Mm. So those are the people that are paying for all these. Public or media tours and all that. Those are the people who stand to lose. Unfortunately, those that society that stands to gain, they don't have the kinds of money, you know, like to stage opposition and so forth. So it's just how it is. So I expect, so you will find, if you were to put a bill that deals with alcohol, that deals with tobacco, that deals with gambling, because these are the things that we all see, we all experience, or sugar, or any of these industries, there will be a fight back, because the let's say industry does not like, once they settle on a particular way of operation, they don't like a disturbance. Mm. You know, like it's like it's a habit. You know, like you wake up, you know that where your car parked it. In the morning when you wake up, you want to go to where you parked the car. But if in the morning someone was to, each time you park the car, then someone takes the car and parks it wherever they want to go, your mind will just not function. Human beings and industry does not work that way. They like to say, no, we are certain that these laws will remain the laws for the next 10 years or so. If you change, please give us time to adjust to these changes, because, you know, like I need to change one or two other things so that I can continue to make profit from this country.
So if your bill, I mean, you say South Africans go to sleep when you talk about certain things, right? We don't read bills. Public engagement really is spearheaded by civil society more than just general individuals. Mm. So if your bill and the way that you have structured it were to succeed, how does that impact society? How would that change everyday life?
So there will be an additional revenue that goes into the fiscus that will then deal with the awareness around the dangers of gambling addiction. That will go into rehabilitating gambling addicts. That will go into the research, continuous research on the harms associated with gambling, but also learning from other jurisdiction, other countries. But also, you know, not having to. And this one, as I said to the minister, you know, you can wake up tomorrow and do it. We don't need 24-hour gambling advertising. We just don't. You know. So let's reduce the exposure, because also some of the taglines that are being used, you know, I say, and you say winners know when to stop. People are not winning, they are losing. So when you say winners know when to stop, here's someone that has just lost 100,000. He has not won, or she has not won. Now you are like, no, continue playing until you win. That's when you're going to stop. Then someone says, no, but the message does not, the way you need to understand it is that when you stop, you have won. Like, no, no, people don't look it that way. They say, you are telling them that they must continue playing. When they win, then they must consider stopping. But majority of people are losing. So what are you saying to the losers? You know, like, you are not warning people around the dangers of gambling addiction. So what I want to see, the message, it's one of the things that I said, like, guys, let's get rid of this thing, is the tagline, winners know when to stop. Let's talk about gambling addiction is harmful. Gambling addiction can take money that you are supposed to pay school fees for your children. You know, that we must, it must be as graphic as the, you know, like some of the labelings in cigarettes and alcohol. Like gambling addiction can kill you. Because people do commit suicide because they are addicted to gambling. So we need a lot more stronger messaging, a lot more stronger public awareness on this particular issue. But now there's a paper that the Treasury has released proposing an online gambling tax. And I would like people to go and read that and send comments to Treasury, because Treasury wants to hear from you whether you agree that currently the gambling companies are under taxed. You know they pay how much? You know how much they pay? 6%. 6% in South Africa. Wow. And you know in the UK. In the UK they used to pay 20% and they just upped it.
Wow.
But the same operators who operate in the UK, they operate in South Africa. They pay 20% in the UK. But they say no, they are happy to pay 6% in South Africa. It can't be. And that's why South Africans need to go to the Treasury website. It's a short document. It's not the documents that Ivor writes. Those ones are
massive. You write short documents too?
He knows how to write long documents. No. So let's comment, but also focus on where the money needs to go. Because if there's one witness, which I've said to the minister yesterday, today's Thursday, I was with the minister on Tuesday during the budget debate. I said, if there's one area that we need to strengthen, is to say, where will the money go? And where do we want the money go? It needs to go to rehabilitation. It needs to go to public awareness. We need to be, you know, the same kind of effort that was done to tobacco, that was done to HIV and AIDS around the dangers and how to protect yourself. It needs to go towards gambling addiction.
Same kind of vigor. And yes. For you, Ivor, your bill is very much focused inside the state. Yours, Makashule, is looking at society and harm to society, and yours is inside the state. So if your bill acts the way that it should, how will it change things inside the state?
I think it will. I can't emphasize the degree to which it will be transformational. So we're talking about South Africa's third transition. The first one being we became a democracy in 1994. We became a constitutional state in 1996. If President Ramaphosa signs the bill this year, 2026 will be the year where we start to transition towards a professional modern administration. And if we do that, we're creating the groundwork for South Africa becoming a prosperous modern democracy. And what that means concretely for everyday people is that it means our administrations which shape our everyday lives, municipalities, service delivery, there will be vast improvements in all those areas. Because many of the crises which we're currently exposed to on a day-to-day basis as ordinary South Africans, whether it's the road traffic, whether it's problems of water and sewage, electricity, these are often crises of institutional administration. And if we start to fix our administrations, and it's not rocket science, we can do it. If we start to fix our administrations, if we start to improve the ability of our institutions to work, we will see the most dramatic changes in our everyday lives. And we've been here before. Think of South African Revenue Services. These are institutional administrative changes. We built effective institutions in the 1990s. We know how to do it. We got sidetracked during the state capture years. We did a huge lot of damage to our institutions. But we know how to build institutions. We need to get back into that. This bill lays the ground, the foundation of that kind of reform. It'll be transformational, I think.
So bills, acts, laws, all of these things are great on paper, but really only as effective as implementation. So what about implementation? What about that stage of making sure that this happens? For instance, you talk a lot about, you know, in 96, we had a particular way of looking at it. In 2004, in 2008, in 2018, why laws and not more regulation or more emphasis on holding people to account?
So what we can hope from the Public Service Amendment Bill and other bills, it's that the people that now have this acquired power, it's because it's acquired, it's moved from one to the other, then use it for the benefit of society. Because sometimes it's not the laws, it's the people, you know, it's a culture. What kind of culture do you build? So what say, for instance, the bill that Ivo speaks to, it lays the foundation for a change in culture. But there must be an appetite for that change. Because if there's no appetite to change, a piece of paper, a legislation, will not change things. So what we then need to deal with is that culture. So what you are talking to, it's a culture of saying, when we have agreed that this is the way to go, then let's move in that direction together. And the person that is given the responsibility to move, they must do so. You know what we would like to see, it's those that are employed, especially those that are employed in the state, they must wake up and do what they are employed to do. You know, you can change a lot of things if people do what they are employed to do. Just by doing what you are employed to do. Just do your job. You are a teacher, go and teach. Your job is to fix traffic lights. Each morning, go and fix traffic lights. If each one of us do what we are supposed to do, then 80% of our problems will be solved. But sometimes it's when people feel like, no, they should not do what they are supposed to be doing. Maybe they deserve to be in a different space and so forth. And maybe at some point, especially when you talk of the state, there will be those that see the state as an employer of the last resort. It ought to be the employer where the best. Because that's, as I said, self-government. So you must send the best people to govern you. I gave the other day an example to municipalities, councils. And I'm like, you see, council is like a board of a company. Council in Johannesburg, it's like a board of a company. That's a 90 billion rand company. Johannesburg, it's a 90 billion rand company. What kind of people do you want to send to be the board members of Johannesburg, if it's your company? You need to send the best people. But at the moment, are the best people excited about going and be board members of Johannesburg as councillors? No, we don't send the best people to look after Johannesburg. And then we are surprised that Johannesburg is not performing the way that it's supposed to. Because there's also this, the stories that we tell about ourselves insofar as the state. There might be those that believe that Or they believe it's possible to have a functional, prosperous South Africa without an effective state. So a prosperous South Africa that's only run by private entities. It's not possible. So the stories that we tell, you know,
I was trying to recruit you.
I don't have to say anything anymore.
Every day people demonize the state in this country. People demonize the state. You look down upon people who work for the state, who work for government. But on the other side, you say, no, we want a safe, a prosperous South Africa. How is that possible without an efficient state? We must talk about these things. We must not allow people to demonize the state on an ongoing basis. But then on the other side, you say, no, that state must perform better than it's supposed to. These are the things that we must be at the forefront of talking, not some of the things that sometimes we concern ourselves with.
I think when you finished working with the Gambling Act, you need to come and work with us. But I think that's exactly, I mean, so you talked about the implementation challenges. One thing that's exciting from my point of view is that if the bill passes, if Ramaphosa signs the bill, its signing will also be in part of its implementation, because immediately it will remove a source of crazy antagonism and conflict in departments. It will remove certain powers immediately from politicians and give it to director generals and heads of department. Because as it currently stands, if you're a director general, for example, you get appointed to do a job. But unless the minister delegates responsibilities to you, certain powers to do it, you actually can't do anything. You can go to your office, but you can sit on your hands. You actually have no powers to do anything unless the minister delegates those powers to you. And many times those ministers don't delegate those powers because the ministers like to have that authority. So what the amendment will do is immediately give the director general and other heads of departments the powers they will need to do their jobs on an everyday basis. So that's already its implementation. But, and the point that you made earlier, which is absolutely spot on, we need the right people in those jobs. So associated with the passing of the Public Service Amendment Bill, there are a whole range of other reforms which also need to happen. Fortunately, a lot of work has been done on that. Professor Mashupie Masiremule and others, for example, have been working on a professionalization framework, operating with the National School of Government to improve the training of candidates, to introduce a minimum entrance exam to the public service, to make sure that promotions are linked to performance. So there's a whole framework which has been developed. Some of it is great. It also needs to be implemented. But there's a lot of work that has been done in this space. So and I ask people, your listeners, please go to the site, nsi.org.za. We've got a campaign, support the signing of the bill. Please have a look at that, support the work which we're doing. That nsi.org.za is our website. We are launching as of today a Sign the Bill campaign. But following that, there's lots of other work to do around advancing a wider agenda of public service reform. And we hope your listeners will be paying attention. And a lot of it has got to do with do your job and get the right people into the public service in a position to do their jobs.
Okay. Yeah,
and if there's one thing I believe we need to invest heavily, especially in the public administration, we need to invest in leadership. Whether it's from school principal to the station commander, everyone that leads other people. Because there's always this thing, especially in the public service, that if you're an expert, so someone who's a good maths teacher, because of the way promotion is done, is that you realize that no, they are the head of that department. The only way that the only next notch is for them to be the principal. Then you take that person to be the principal, but they're not good leaders. And if there's one thing, and I've said this to the ministers, let's invest in leadership development in the public service. So whether you are leading a clinic, you are leading a station, you are leading a school, wherever you are leading other people, let's not just take someone just because now they've developed expertise and now we say, no, we can't promote you above being the head here. Now we need to make you the manager. Not everyone is a leader and a manager. And that's one thing that we need to do in the public sector.
And we need young people. We need young people. We've just done a piece of work. It's an astonishing, the results. We were the first to have got access to all anonymized data of human HR data in government as a whole. The results, and it's never been analyzed before. It's incredible. We've got 15, 20 years of data across the whole of government. The results are astonishing. The generation of public servants that entered government in 1994 are reaching retirement age. Mm. Our nurses, our policemen, our staff are old. They're my age and older. They're in their 50s. Or some of them are approaching 60s. Our average policeman is in their 40s. the guys responding to average crime, dealing with youngsters on the street, they are in their 40s and sometimes in their 50s. In other words, these guys, our public servants, are going. The senior leadership are going to be leaving soon. There are no young people in the public service. So we've got something which we can deal with urgently now, but we need to start focusing on young people and bringing hundreds and thousands of young people into our departments because they're the future.
Sure. I think that's a fantastic place to end. Thank you so much for coming in and having this conversation. One bill shapes government from within and one protects the society from harm. And I think I love the fact that we're ending with, if you just go and do your job, we're all at least 50% of the way there. Because one of the jobs our president has to do is go and sign the bills.
Exactly. Sign the bill, Mr. President.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time and thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.